What is up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Year of Plenty podcast, the show for all things real food and the processes that bring it to the table. As always, I'm your host, Poldy Wieland, and today I have a solo episode for you all. No guests, sadly, but that's all right. I did a bunch of research for this episode and have some extensive notes so that I can bring you guys some value here. Today, I want to share four plant species to go after this spring, you know, some inspiration for your foraging. And the four plants I'm going to go over are ramps, salsify, thimbleberry, and the cottonwood. So if any of these are new for you or you want to get some more insight into them, keep listening. As always, this is the Year of Plenty podcast. If you enjoy it, incinerate that subscribe button. Leave a 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Yes, Spotify does reviews now. It's super easy. It takes like 2 seconds, so definitely consider doing that. Also, if you want to help me keep the lights on and keep cranking out more episodes for you, you can make a small monthly donation on Patreon. A link to the Patreon is in the podcast episode description. That is greatly appreciated. Please check that out if you're getting a lot of value from the episodes. Otherwise, if you want to connect with me, follow me on Instagram, which is at Poldy Wieland. There's also a Facebook and a Twitter page for the podcast, but Instagram is where I'm most active. So definitely just follow me there. Let's start a conversation and learn from each other. All right, keeping this intro real short today, let's get straight into this episode. Okay, everybody, the 2022 foraging season is upon us. I am super pumped to get after some new species this year, and I hope you all are just as excited as myself to really get out there and start exploring a bit more. This will be my first spring here in Montana, and I'm pretty interested in seeing, you know, how the ecosystems come back to life out here after such a long winter with the mountains and everything. And also, you know, I'm very interested in how the different elevations will affect the grow cycles of different plants and mushroom species, since that's something I haven't really had to deal with in the past in Wisconsin. You know, I did live in La Crosse, so there's bluffs and whatnot, but there's no mountains and no serious elevation gain like out here. So that's definitely going to be changing my foraging game for sure, and it's going to be something to adjust to, but something I'm also very excited about. So like every year around this time, I took out all my foraging books. I opened up all my foraging websites, like my favorite ones, to just gain some inspiration and explore some of the wild edibles that'll be popping up here in early to late spring. And if you're new to foraging, this is really something I recommend you do, because the spring is full of foraging opportunities and often the windows for harvest are quite short. So you want to be prepared ahead of time and have some idea of what you want to go after before the season actually gets going. That way you don't scramble when you see like all these foraging posts go up on social media and, you know, all the foraging groups online, because for me at least, that in the past has caused a lot of FOMO, and I think it's just best to avoid all of that. Now, to help give you guys some inspiration on what plants you could pursue this year, I figured I'd sit down and share four plant species that I will be going after from spring to summer. Well, actually, the first one I'm going to share, I really can't go after here in Montana, but it's one that I want to talk about because it's definitely one of my favorites that I've been going after for many, many years. And I know a lot of you out there in the East Coast, you know, in the Midwest, will have the opportunity to go after it. Now, there are a ton of species to go after in the coming months, especially plants, but I think it's easy to get overwhelmed. So whether you go after like the ones I'm sharing here today, or you pick your own list of species to go after, my one word of advice is really not to try to go after too many. Focus on the few and not the many, but really get to know those few. Otherwise, you know, you might just get overwhelmed again. And I think it's just better to focus on those few and really get to know those well. Find a lot of spots, because that'll then pay off year after year. Now, before I start, as always, I got to have a quick disclaimer in here. I am not responsible for what you guys put into your mouth. Like, please, 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 before you eat any wild foods, any wild edibles, know what you're eating. Like, don't just eat everything. And I'm not responsible if anything happens to you. So I just got to say that. But with that out of the way, let's jump right into it. So the first plant I really want to touch on are, you probably guessed it, I alluded to it a bit earlier, ramps, also known as wild leeks. This is a forager's favorite. They're highly, highly sought after in spring, especially by like chefs and restaurants and, you know, anyone who really knows about them, I would say. I talk about ramps all the time, and I have religiously been focusing on harvesting them for the last 4 years. And it's not only because they're like so freaking tasty, but also because they're beautiful, like actually beautiful. And I hold like a special place in my heart for them. I freaking love watching rams take over the forest floor before so many other plants come out. It's just a really beautiful sight. And they just have this awesome smell. I mean, ramps for me is like, you know, spring is here, summer is coming. It just always gets me super pumped. Now, ramps are in the genus Allium, which includes hundreds of plants like different onions, garlic, scallions, leeks, etc. They were important in many Native American cuisines, and its European brethren, the bear leek, is actually quite a similar plant. And that's something that even like indigenous European people have been going after and incorporating into their cuisine for thousands of years. And that's like actually one of the first plants I ever went after with my mom as a kid. So the bear leek, very similar to the ramp. Now, ramps grow close to the ground, and they usually have 2 to 3 leaves that are a beautiful spring green. And they're attached to a teardrop bulb. They're also perennial, so this means they will grow new leaves from the bulb year after year, and they can live like multiple years, which makes these prime for cultivation and foraging. And actually, you know, there's ramp fields out there in like, you know, Wisconsin and other parts of the U.S. where they think that these, I mean, they're so big and so well kept that they think that Native Americans were like cultivating them for many, many decades, which that's kind of cool to think about. Every part of the plant has a strong onion smell and flavor, which is why I love it. And on top of that, they are high in vitamin C, which, you know, that would have been important for our primal ancestors, like after a long winter with little plants to really go after. I mean, you can get vitamin C in like some organ meats and whatnot, but, you know, usually as humans, we get it from certain plants, a lot of from fruits and whatnot. So you can kind of see how that would have been important, you know, as the snow melts and the ramps come up. I can really see how like Native Americans and just others of our human ancestry would have really tried to pursue them in the past and try to get after harvesting them. As far as ramps go, you will usually find large clumps of ramps with the bulbs tightly packed together in a given area. I know spots in Wisconsin where they cover like the entire forest floor as far as the eye can see in the spring. And those are really the ideal spots to harvest them, because when you have a ton like that, you don't have to worry about over-harvesting or anything like that. Now, you know, if you're thinking about getting after ramps, they're found in the eastern half of the United States for the most part, from the northern parts of Minnesota and anywhere east from there. They also grow south in the Appalachians to Tennessee and Georgia, and even western parts of Missouri and Iowa. Sadly, I have not heard of them being anywhere here in the Pacific Northwest or the Rockies. Yeah, kind of sucks because I do love going after these, but luckily there are other allium plants, like other onion plants to go after out there that I still need to learn about. Now, we talked about, you know, big picture where they grow, but what kind of like area do they like to grow in? Ramps love areas with rich, dark and really moist soil in like mesic hardwood forests and floodplains of rivers and streams. That's where I've been finding them in Wisconsin, like these, you know, awesome hardwood forests with, you know, elm and maple and oak. And just like these forests have just an intensely dark, rich soil that, you know, gets covered with deciduous leaves year after year and just has time to recover during the winter and just build a strong microbiota. It's honestly, I mean, every time I've gone out, I look at the soil and I'm like, holy crap, this is like every gardener's dream. And that's where you're going to find ramps. If you are in an area with sugar maples, then you definitely lucked out, because that's like one of the trees that they're strongly associated with. So definitely look for forests with a lot of sugar maples. And, you know, if you do live in like a drier, hotter region, it's best to really look for them in cool ravines and north-facing slopes. Like north-facing slopes are always good because, you know, they're usually going to stay moister during the summer when it gets drier. So that's definitely a place to look for when you're going after rams. Now, when you're like actually harvesting the rams, you know, I think you should be aware of their slow growth cycle. Rams can take years to really reach maturity and reproductive age. So if you take a lot from a small patch, it might not be able to recover for a long, long time, or it might not be able to recover at all. So that's definitely something to consider. Like, I really only take the bulbs if I know I have a giant patch of rams. As far as cooking goes, rams are super versatile in the kitchen, and you know they can be used as an onion or garlic substitute in any meal. My favorite thing to really make out of them is ram pesto. That's been just an awesome thing to make year after year, and I like making pesto with them because all you really have to do is collect those leaves. So, you know, you can leave the bulb in the ground, and that allows the plant to recover and grow back new leaves year after year. So that kind of goes with the sustainability thing I was just talking about, you know, really only taking the bulbs if you have a giant field. I could talk a lot more about rams, but if you want like a really in-depth view into this plant, I did a whole episode on them like a while back. So just scroll back in the, in the episode list, and you should find that. And that's an episode where I really, really get into the nitty-gritty of rams. So definitely check that out. So let's move on to the second plant. The second plant I want to talk about is a relatively new one for me. And I've only harvested this one once before during my time in the Pacific Northwest in 2020. This plant is called salsify. Now, salsify is in the Asteraceae family. I hope I'm saying that right. I always have trouble with these Latin names. But that's basically the sunflower family. Other plants in that family include like daisies, chamomile, arnica, and so on. So other plants you might be familiar with. And if you've never heard of salsify, you guys might know them by other names. Like other names for it is the oyster plant or ghost beard. I've only really heard about them under the name salsify. But yeah, over the last couple of weeks, I've been doing a lot of research on them just to kind of refresh my memory because, you know, I just can't wait to get my hands on more of them this year. And it seems to be like a really popular one or a really good plant to go after here in the Rockies. Salsify can be harvested from early spring to early winter in some places. There are like three species that grow all over the U.S., some more so than others in different states. But yeah, they're supposedly everywhere, so that's good news, right? It's also a biennial, so not a perennial like the ramp. It's a biennial, meaning that it has a life cycle of 2 years. Interestingly, though, this is one of the plants that humans have cultivated, and the cultivated types were actually like popular vegetables in the past. But similar to asparagus, there are like wild and feral types we can forage for in the wild that are pretty identical to these cultivated ones. So I thought that was pretty cool. But from what I've been reading, this is somewhat of a low-key plant that often kind of goes ignored by foragers, especially because it looks very similar to a bunch of different grasses out there. So they're just often overseen and really kind of take a keen eye to find inside of meadows, for example. Nonetheless, though, they are delicious and every part of the plant is edible. I always like to hear that when every part of the plant is edible. What I'm after in the early spring here in Montana are the first year basil rosettes of this plant. These first year plants have a prime taproot. So we're looking for the root here. The taproots can grow anywhere from 1 to 8 inches thick at the crown and kind of resemble like a wacky carrot, maybe, I would say. They're whitish to beige colored with a thick skin. The roots from wild salsify are smaller than the cultivated types, but you know, otherwise they're pretty identical in flavor and texture. Now, as I mentioned just a second ago, what you want to look for here in the spring are these basil rosettes of the first year plant. In an area with lots of bare soil and like little pressure from, you know, other plants that could crowd it out, the leaves of salsify will lay pretty flat on the ground. But in a place like a meadow, they will usually grow erect into the sky. So that's something to consider. The first year leaves will also usually get up to like 14 inches in length. So you're not looking for stuff that's, you know, much longer than 14 inches at its max. The salsify leaves are hard to distinguish from other grasses at first glance, especially in like the meadows and prairies. So I want to share some ways you can distinguish them from grasses that I learned from Sam Thayer in one of his foraging books. He's a legendary forager, and I definitely recommend that you guys get all of his books. They're a very good investment. So the leaves are slender and pointy to the top, but one way that they're different from many grasses out there is that they grow from this rosette. And I've talked about this rosette here a little bit already. So a rosette is a botanical term. If a plant grows in a rosette form, the leaves will radiate from like a center stalk, either right at the ground level or close to the ground. So they're all basically growing from a center point very symmetrically, and it kind of resembles a rose pattern, hence like the name rosette. And according to Sam Thayer in his book, there aren't really many grasses that do this. Like, there aren't many grasses that grow from a rosette. So that's the first ID factor to kind of tell the salsify apart from just random grasses in the meadow. Another way you can tell them apart from grass species is that the leaves of salsify have a very deep V shape. Some grasses might have this, but salsify has like a very, very, very deep V. On top of that, the midvein of the leaves that, you know, the midvein that kind of runs right in the middle of the leaf, it's light colored and hollow. So when you have a leaf in your hand and you're like, oh, wondering, is this a salsify or not? One thing to do is just kind of break that leaf off and then like look at this midvein and see if it's hollow. Like in a cross section, you want it to be hollow and airy. Supposedly, this is again one of those ID factors that you can use to tell it apart from random grass species. But the best indicator I recently learned about for salsify is that it has a latex fluid that comes out of every part of the salsify plant. So this is similar to dandelions, which I'm sure a lot of you have seen before or held in your hands before. You know, when you break off the dandelion, you'll see this white latex come out of it. Same goes for salsify, and no grasses, as far as I know, produce latex like this. So that's a really, really good one to know. And if you're in a meadow with a bunch of grasses around and you're thinking like, do I have salsify or not? You know, check some of these ID factors before you start taking the plant back home and using it in the kitchen. Now, if you're looking for the salsify in the summer, you can also check for the second year plants in the area, because those will grow a flowering stalk from the center of this rosette. And the stalk can typically grow up to 5 feet tall and will later like branch out and grow a ton of composite flower heads. The flowers are usually yellow, but there's one of the three species called T. porifolius, and that'll actually have purple flowers. So that's something to be aware of. And you know, when I'm going after a plant species for the first time, I often like to wait until the flowers grow. You know, many plants in the spring look just super similar, and it's hard to tell them apart. But once you have the flower in your hand, that's often like one of the best ways to just count out some of the lookalikes. If you want to wait for flowers to ID your salsify, those will usually grow late spring through early summer. So definitely be on the lookout for those if this is a new plant for you. One more ID factor I want to share with you is that when the flowers like actually do go to seed, they look like puffy dandelion heads, just way bigger. So that's why many people refer to salsify as giant dandelion. And you might have seen some of that on your summer hikes in the past and just never realized that that is a salsify plant. So where do these grow? Well, we talked about them growing everywhere in the US, basically on like a macro level, but on a micro level, like in an actual area that you're looking for them, you want to look for the salsify in disturbed grounds with lots of direct sunlight. They love lots of direct sunlight. Like so many other wild edibles, they are considered a weed and do grow like one, which, you know, is pretty good news for some of us who know about them and seek them out as a food source. Weeds or plants that grow like a weed are always good to get after, because there's likely going to be a lot of them. And, you know, if I were looking for them, I would look for salsify in abandoned fields, maybe around prairie trails, big meadows that get a lot of sun. You can also look on or around crop field edges, gravel pits, and then even riverbanks. They do thrive around roadsides, especially out here in Montana, from what I was reading. But I personally would not collect them for food in those areas. You know, all the roads just have a lot of runoff, and that runoff will then irrigate these plants, and the chemicals then get, you know, into the taproot and other parts of the plants. The same kind of does go for crop fields. You know, unless you know that the farmer is following like strict organic practices, I would stay away from those plants. But, you know, you might, however, look around roadsides to become familiar with the plant, since from what I was reading, they do really, really thrive there, especially out here in the Rockies. So, like, I'm likely to go out and just look on roadsides, see if I can find one, take a closer look at these plants, go through all my ID factors, and then, you know, that'll help me become more confident in collecting them in other places. Now, the most efficient way to harvest the root is with a shovel, especially in the spring when the ground can still be slightly frozen. I learned that the hard way when I was harvesting parsnips last year. I brought a little like foldable shovel, and the ground was pretty freaking frozen still. And yeah, I actually broke my shovel real fast. When I harvested them in 2020, the Pacific Northwest, we used like digging sticks, and that actually worked pretty well. So that's, you know, later in the year, a shovel is probably unnecessary. Also, you know, who likes carrying a shovel while they're hiking, especially in the backcountry? So, you know, that's something to consider. But in the spring, I can definitely recommend a good shovel. Once you have, you know, a basket full of these roots, it's time to prep them in the kitchen. So let's talk a little bit about that. The roots can be used like any other rooty vegetables in the kitchen, but you don't want them to sit around for very long because they do tend to go bad real fast and they'll turn like a dark reddish brown. You know, that's when you don't want them anymore. I'm excited to gather some and then kind of use them in stews and soups. And you can also preserve the root for later use by blanching and freezing them. So that's another thing you can do. Now, as far as sustainability goes, there really aren't any concerns with over-harvesting this one. It's actually an invasive from Europe. And, you know, it has little trouble spreading its seeds via the wind. So they proliferate in many areas quite easily and quickly. So, yeah, have at it. All right, let's move on to plant number three, the delicious thimbleberry. You might be thinking berries in spring, Poldy, really? Well, I'm not going to be talking about berry harvest here, which isn't until summer or late summer if you've harvested berries before, you'll know that. But more so, I'll be going after the young thimbleberry shoots this spring. These shoots are also referred to as bear candy because bears freaking love them and they gorge themselves on them after hibernation. So that's a win-win for those of us that forage and hunt because, you know, where the thimbleberries are will also likely be where the bears are. And I don't know about you, but I'm trying to get a spring bear this year. 2020, my freezer meat is going fast, so I need a bear in my life. Actually, I'm going to be going to the range today to sight in my rifle, finally found ammo for my German caliber 8x57. Don't ever get that caliber in the US. It's just impossible to get ammo for. But after recording this, I'm going to head out there and get that rifle sighted in for bear season, which starts in a couple weeks here. Super pumped. But yeah, back to thimbleberries. They don't grow everywhere, sadly, in the US. That's kind of a bummer, I know. They're mainly found here in the Pacific Northwest and the Rockies, but there are also some good populations around the Great Lakes, and I have friends who have found them up there in numbers. So, yeah, sorry if they don't grow around you, but maybe you can find like a similar plant to go after. As far as I know, there's a lot of the, you know, raspberry and blackberry, like other plants where you can just have at it with the shoots in the spring. So definitely check that out. Now, where to look for them? Well, they like to grow in shady areas, but I found some in like more sunny areas around streams where the soil is wet and the microclimate is cooler. So definitely, first I would look in shady areas, but don't always count out those areas, you know, that might have some sunlight or direct sunlight. But yeah, shady areas first. So I would look for them under high canopy conifer forests out here, which lucky for me, we have a ton of in Montana. Let's talk about some ID factors. Like raspberries and blackberries, the thimbleberries grow in thickets that reach a few feet in height. The reason they grow in thickets like this is that thimbleberries spread as rhizomes, which are like extensions of their stem underground. And these rhizomes will grow horizontally underground and then shoot up a bunch of different shoots in the area. And then, you know, that just creates a thicket, which is what we want as foragers. The more plant, the more berries, the more shoots. That's what I'm talking about. Now, thimbleberries also don't have thorns. That's a huge ID factor to distinguish them from raspberries and blackberries that might grow in the same area. So keep that in mind, no thorns. And the no thorn thing was a big help for me when I really first started going after them last year and trying to find my first patches. Another thing to look at are the leaves. Now, thimbleberry leaves kind of look like maple leaves and they're palmate with five lobes. Those lobes have then jagged edges all around them. On top of that, the leaves are soft and fuzzy, which is why some call them toilet paper plant. So a little hint here, next time you got to go into backcountry, you know, you don't have those dude wipes or those toilet paper with you. Try to find some thimbleberry leaves maybe. Personally, I have not gone after thimbleberries in the spring, but based on my experience with other plants and harvesting other plants in the spring, I'm not expecting to find a ton of leaves at this time of the year. You know, I may be expecting some dry leaves, some big dry leaves from the prior year, and then maybe some fresh growth, some new, young, fresh leaves from the current year. But, you know, that's all right, because I really care about the shoots in the spring. You know, not really the leaves, but I do hear that the young leaves are edible and that people do like to harvest them, especially for tea. So that might be something I'm going to do because I really want to go hard on making tea this year. You know, there's so many wild edible plants out there that are just prime for making tea. And I drink a lot of tea and tea can be expensive. So why not just make your own, you know? Okay, so another thing to consider is that the young thimbleberry shoots will come up at the base of the plant next to the mature stalks and they will have a bright green color. As the year goes on, those shoots will then turn brown and woody. So if you're going to harvest these, only take the shoots that you can easily pinch off with your fingers. So from what I've been learning about them, you know, the young shoots are really fresh and tart tasting, which I freaking love. I will probably just eat them raw or like treat them similar to asparagus when cooking. And I will also be using them for like quick pickling, which is something I've been doing a lot more of this year. And, you know, I never realized quick pickling was so easy. It takes like 10 minutes, if even. A good one to start with is just get some onions from the grocery store and try some quick pickling recipes. I mean, it's just vinegar and some other ingredients and super easy to do. And it's something I'll definitely be doing with the thimbleberry shoots. But yeah, that's the thimbleberry. So we talked about rams. We talked about the salsify and we talked about thimbleberries. Let's go on to the last plant. The last plant I want to share with you guys is the cottonwood tree. Yeah, you heard me right. I actually had no idea that parts of the cottonwood are edible. I mean, I've walked past hundreds of cottonwood trees during my time in the woods, and you know, I never looked at them as like food. But now I will be because I just learned more about them. And I wanted to include them here in this episode because you know, they grow in eastern, western, central, and even southwestern parts of the U.S., even in Europe. So I'm thinking that many of you listening should be able to find them and find them quite easily. In Montana, I have seen a lot of them, or I usually see them around the river basins in the valley. They're also not very hard to spot. Cottonwoods can grow anywhere from 50 to 80 feet tall, and there have been some recorded that are like over 100 feet tall, which is nuts. They don't have a ton of edible parts as far as I know, but from what I've been learning now, foragers like to go after their buds in the early spring. You want to get these tiny flower buds when they're still closed, but you also don't want to get them too early because then they can be quite bitter. If you get them at the right stage, like right between, you know, them turning into flowers, but a little later than them just starting to grow, they supposedly have like a pleasant, complex, sweet and spicy aroma. And they're nice to just nibble on spring walks. Now, you know, one thing is, I mean, I mentioned how big these trees get and these flower buds are on the branches. And those branches are often really dang high up there. So unless you're like a super climber, like a monkey, you know, what you might want to do is look for fresh branches that fall through wind or maybe get, you know, torn down by animals. And you'll be able to find those around the trees. And, you know, those fresh branches should still have these flowering buds on there in the spring. And obviously you want to look for some that still look good and fresh. I'm going to try to get some of these here in the early spring in Montana now. I've already actually seen some on trees, so I hope I'm not too late. Probably not. I mean, again, the elevation is nice to have around here because the seasons can be a little staggered. But basically, what I'm going to do is use these flower buds and infuse honey with them. From what I've been reading and, you know, seeing in Facebook groups and in my books, all you really have to do to infuse the honey is like get a glass jar, get some buds, some flower buds, put them in there, fill the jar about halfway up with these flower buds, then dump a bunch of high quality raw honey on there. You know, none of that super processed, highly heated, you know, honey in a bear bottle, plastic bear bottle bullshit. That's not the honey you want to eat. You want to get some good quality raw honey, ideally from a local source. Put that in there. And some people then even like to add like bark from branches and whatnot, just like fresh bark, just little pieces of that for some more flavor, I guess. And then you just leave that honey sitting in a warm spot for about a week. And the final result will be an infused honey with an interesting taste that you can use as a culinary ingredient that has like a sweet and spicy aroma, which sounds really cool to me. And, you know, you can use it as a sweetener in teas or like in any other recipe that, you know, you might be interested in. Just experiment with it a bit. But these flower buds really aren't the only thing you can eat from the cottonwood in the spring. So you can actually eat the cambium layer of cottonwoods as well. And it's more so a survival food. So if you don't know, the cambium on the tree is the soft layer between the outer and inner bark. And in the spring, when the sap is flowing, it supposedly has like a really nice sweet flavor and is like soft enough to chew easily. Now, the only thing that does kind of suck about getting this stuff, this cambium layer, is that you have to whittle away the outer bark of the tree. And in doing so, you're going to be damaging the tree, hurting the tree. You know, probably the tree can recover depending on how much you're taking. But that's why I said you should treat the cambium layer from cottonwoods more so as like a survival food. You know, maybe not something you're harvesting all the time. One thing you can consider, though, is like similar to the buds, you can try to get this cambium layer from like freshly fallen branches. That way, you know, you can take as much as you want and you don't have to worry about like damaging the tree at all. Personally, I have never harvested anything from the cottonwood. This is just stuff I've been learning about, reading about, and I want to share with you. But I will definitely try to get some this year. What's good about the cottonwood out here in Montana especially is that that's where a lot of the oyster mushrooms are going to be later in the summer. So, you know, that's something to consider if you're going out and harvesting cottonwood. Definitely look for maybe bigger dead cottonwood trees that you can then mark the spot of and then like go back to later in the summer because they might carry some big flushes of oyster mushrooms. That way you're killing two birds with one stone and you're being an efficient forager. So that's something to definitely be aware of. And, you know, hey, more wild food with less effort. That's what we're all about. All right. That's all for plants. I mean, I could have talked about many more here, but I think these are some good species to get you guys started on your spring foraging journey. If you do want to look for some other spring plants this year, you know, I would look for wild asparagus and maybe some bee balm. Those are easy to find and readily available kind of in many, many places around the U.S. But yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode and learned a ton from it. That's what it's really all about for me, you know, sharing this knowledge, learning about it. I learned from you guys, you learned from me. But again, I got to throw this in here, but I am not responsible for what you guys put in your mouth and eat. So please, please, please do your due diligence and make sure you have the right plant or right mushroom before you're going to ingest it, before you're going to eat it. Okay. If you want to start a conversation with me, definitely reach out on Instagram. I'm more than happy to talk. You know, like I said, I learned from you guys. You guys learned from me. I love having conversations. And yeah, it's just something I look forward to when you guys reach out and give me feedback about the podcast and just give me new inspiration. because that way we're all learning from each other. So if you guys really like this episode, please let me know, because you know I can do more of these for summer and fall plants and mushrooms. Yeah, I had fun researching this episode. Helps me prep for my foraging this year. And yeah, then I can share it with all of you. So definitely let me know if this is good. All right, that's it. Thank you so much for listening. I truly appreciate your support. Let's keep exploring real foods together. Bye-bye.